This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Paula Simchak. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the July 12, 2026 edition of the Milford Daily News. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham died from a brief and sudden illness on Saturday, his office said in a statement. He was 71. In his more than three decades in Washington, Graham played major roles in crafting key pieces of legislation that affected millions of Americans' lives, while also developing a reputation as a stark foreign policy hawk. Preliminary examination findings determined that Graham died of an aortic dissection caused by arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease, according to the senator's office. President Donald Trump, a friend of Graham's, said he spoke with a South Carolina lawmaker shortly before emergency responders arrived at his home in Washington on Saturday night. Emergency personnel said they were conducting CPR on a man suffering from cardiac arrest, according to public safety radio feeds reviewed by USA Today. Trump said Graham was like a member of the family who knew how to work with members of both political parties and loved serving in the U.S. Senate. Graham had recently returned from meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and had called Trump about the Save America Act, a sweeping piece of voting legislation. "He's a tough one to lose," Trump said in a phone interview Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. "He was great. He was unique in every way, actually." A preliminary examination from the medical examiner of the District of Columbia found that Graham died from an aortic dissection due to arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease, according to Taylor Reedy, the senator's communications director. Reedy said the findings are preliminary and that additional testing is underway. The death certificate will be pending until all the toxicological and microscopic testing are finalized, and at that point the death certificate will be updated to reflect the cause of death and appropriately classify the manner of death, Graham's office said in a statement. Former President George W. Bush and his wife, former First Lady Laura Bush, mourned the loss of Graham in a statement Sunday. "Laura and I were saddened to wake up to the shocking news of Senator Lindsey Graham's death," Bush said. "He was a knowledgeable senator who understood how the world works and how important America's international engagement is to resist tyranny." Bush said Graham was a kind and funny man who loved America and loved serving the country. "South Carolina was fortunate to have such a committed public servant in his corner," Bush said, "and I was fortunate to have known Lindsey Graham." The White House lowered its flag to half-staff on Sunday in honor of Graham's legacy. It is tradition for flags to be lowered after the death of notable Americans who have impacted public policy. In a later Truth Social post, Trump ordered all American flags to be lowered to half-mast until the night of July 19th. In honor of the remarkable life and achievements of Senator Lindsey Graham, a dear friend of mine and a truly great man who achieved so much for our country and his beloved home state of South Carolina, I am ordering all American flags throughout the United States lowered to half-mast until Saturday evening at 6 p.m., Trump wrote. "God bless you, Lindsey," Trump said. Once political rivals who both ran for the presidency in 2016, Trump and Graham later became political allies after the 2018 death of Graham's close friend, Arizona Senator John McCain. Former President Joe Biden is mourning the loss of his former close friend, Graham, saying he and former First Lady Jill Biden are shocked by the sudden passing. "Lindsey and I served together in Congress for over a decade and worked closely on many issues throughout the years," Biden said in a statement. "We traveled the world together as members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We disagreed often and sometimes loudly. Lindsey and I did agree on the profound importance of public service," Biden said. "Like me, he loved the Senate as an institution, even with all its flaws and complexities." Biden said he was keeping Graham's family, staff, and constituents in his prayers. Biden and Graham were friends for decades, but their relationship cooled after the Biden administration's removal of American troops from Afghanistan in August 2021 and amid Graham's staunch support for Trump. FBI Director Kash Patel said the Federal Bureau of Investigation is assisting local law enforcement officials in the handling of Graham's death. "Senator Lindsey Graham was a devoted public servant, a fierce defender of our nation, and a true patriot who dedicated his life to the people of South Carolina and the United States," Patel wrote in a statement on Sunday, offering prayers for the senator's loved ones and colleagues. "The FBI is assisting local authorities and has made every necessary resource available," Patel said. Vice President J.D. Vance said in a statement that Graham came from humble beginnings and became one of the most powerful lawmakers in the most powerful nation on earth, calling the senator's life story a fundamentally American one. Vance recalled getting into a shouting match with Graham about a Ukraine funding bill at a lunch early in his Senate tenure, but he learned the next day that behind the scenes, Graham was supporting rail legislation that Vance had backed. That was Lindsey Graham. He fought like hell for the things he believed in, and he was just as willing to go to bat for you when it counted, Vance said, also praising Graham's humor. We certainly had our disagreements, but I couldn't help but like him, Vance said, a one-of-a-kind figure in our politics. I'll be praying for him and his family. Trump said he has an individual in mind as his preference to replace Graham as the next U.S. senator from South Carolina, but declined to reveal the person. I have somebody that I think would be great, but I don't want to say it now because it's just too soon with Lindsey, Trump said on NBC's Meet the Press. I don't even want to talk about anybody, but I do have somebody who I think is really good. Under South Carolina law, Governor Henry McMaster, a Trump ally, is tasked with appointing an interim replacement before a special election will be held in August to choose the next senator. They'll have some people joining, Trump said of the special election. Some are good, some are bad. But I have somebody that I like, but I'm not going to tell you now because it's too soon. Trump, during his interview with NBC's Meet the Press, said Graham seemed tired on their phone call hours before the senator was pronounced dead, but said Graham did not mention feeling ill. Graham had recently arrived back in Washington from a long flight from Ukraine, where he met with Zelensky. He said he's a little tired. It's a long trip, you know, many hours, and he had just gotten back, Trump said. On the call, he told me, Kristen, I feel good, but I'm tired, Trump said, referring to Meet the Press host Kristen Welker. Trump said first responders arrived at Graham's location in Washington not long after he spoke to him around 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I mean, it must have been right after that, because I understand the police or whoever it is came there about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening, or something like that. Trump said Sunday that Graham was like a member of the family, remembering him as someone who knew how to work with lawmakers from both political parties and loved serving in the U.S. Senate. He was such an advocate. If he wanted to get something, he had a unique ability to deal with Democrats and Republicans, Trump said in a phone interview on NBC's Meet the Press. If I had a problem, a real problem, I wouldn't often ask. But if I had a problem with a Democrat, he could work it out. He was a great politician, actually. Trump said Graham loved being a politician, predicting he would easily win his re-election bid in November. He was going to have a big victory, and the people love him. Everybody loved him. Well, no, he had some enemies. He was a tough cookie. Don't misunderstand. If he thought he was right and he had people against him, he could be very tough, actually. Emergency responders were dispatched to the Capitol Hill home of Senator Lindsey Graham around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, following a report of someone suffering chest pain, according to audio on the Broadcastify website, which archives public safety radio feeds. The dispatcher indicated that the caller was on their way to the home from Baltimore, according to the audio. The dispatcher said the caller believed the door was unlocked, but emergency responders said it was deadbolted and that they knocked repeatedly. The dispatcher then appeared to request the Metropolitan Police Department gain access to the home. The police department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Just after 8:50 p.m., emergency personnel said CPR was in progress and that a man was suffering from cardiac arrest, according to the audio. Graham's cause of death has not been released. In a statement, the lawmaker's office said he passed away from a brief and sudden illness. Trump said he spoke to Graham on the phone around 7 p.m. Eastern Time Saturday night, after the senator returned from Ukraine, and hours before he was pronounced dead. I got a call last night, sometime in the early evening, maybe in the sevens, Trump said in a phone interview on NBC's Meet the Press, the Sunday morning program that Graham was scheduled to appear on. He called and he said, "We're all set on the Save America Act." He was pushing the Save America Act like crazy. Trump said he told Graham, "We're going to get it done, Lindsey," referring to the passage of the long-stalled bill Trump had pushed to overhaul voting in federal elections. Trump said he told Graham he will see him soon. We thought we might even meet today. And then that was it, the president said. It could have been his last call. I don't know exactly. Graham's death has raised questions about Senate Republicans' 52-47 majority. Graham's former seat is now vacant, and former Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has been hospitalized since June 14th. According to the 17th Amendment, governors can make temporary appointments and must hold special elections to fill Senate vacancies. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster will likely appoint a successor to fill Graham's seat and schedule a special election to replace him. The Senate is expected to return Monday, July 13, after a two-week recess. Annie Andrews, a South Carolina Democratic Senate candidate who is expected to face off against Graham in November, said in a post on social media, I hope the South Carolinians will join me in setting partisanship aside and offering gratitude to Senator Lindsey Graham for his service. My deepest condolences are with the family of Senator Lindsey Graham, his friends, his devoted staff, and all who are grieving this sudden and tremendous loss, Andrews said. She continued, from his small-town South Carolina roots to the halls of the U.S. Senate, he was a man of great faith who proudly served our nation as a JAG officer and Air Force colonel. Andrews, a pediatrician and frequent Graham critic, launched her candidacy to challenge the senator in May 2025 after losing a 2022 race in South Carolina's Lowcountry against embattled Representative Nancy Mace. Graham met with Zelensky just days ago in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital city. "Good meeting with U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham," Zelensky wrote on social media on Friday. "This is already his 10th visit to our country, and we appreciate his support," Zelensky said. "I am grateful to Lindsey for recognizing our warriors." In a statement on his official X account, Zelensky said he was deeply saddened by the news of Graham's death, calling the senator a defender of freedom and the values that make our world safer. "Our condolences go out to Lindsey's family, loved ones, and everyone who had the privilege of working alongside him," Zelensky said. Graham, a regular on Sunday morning political talk shows, was previously expected to appear on NBC's Meet the Press with moderator Kristen Welker before his death. In a social media post, Welker said Graham's appearance would have been his 64th time on the nation's longest-running TV show. "We are sending our deepest condolences to his family and colleagues," Welker said. The Meet the Press moderator also revealed that Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will join the program to share personal reflections on Graham's life and legacy. Longtime Graham family friend Meghan McCain, a former co-host of The View, mourned the senator's death in an early morning social media post on Sunday. McCain said she first met Graham when she was 11 after he attended a political event with her father, former Arizona Senator John McCain. Graham, her father, and the late Senator Joe Lieberman were longtime friends and dubbed themselves the Three Amigos. "My dad was the soul of the group, Joe was the heart of the group, and Lindsey was the fire and humor," McCain wrote. She said the trio remained friends throughout their lives, calling the bond rare and nearly extinct. "The memories I will hold of dear of Lindsey is that he was always the person you hoped you sat next to at a dinner party," McCain said. "Charming, very, very fun, very funny. Like so funny, truly could have had a career in stand-up comedy." The Citizen McCain podcast host said Graham was a constant source of support to Senator McCain's widow, Cindy McCain, in the wake of his 2018 death. "The news of his sudden passing is shocking and deeply saddening for me and my family," McCain said. "Like many relationships in life, mine with Lindsey was complex in later years." In the years after her father's death, McCain repeatedly criticized Graham. The South Carolina senior senator developed a close relationship with Trump, a foe of McCain's father. Graham, an Air Force veteran and a former state legislator, served for more than three decades on Capitol Hill. He first came to the House of Representatives after victory in the 1994 elections, before later being elected to serve in the Senate in 2002, succeeding Strom Thurmond. He was a major backer of Israel in Washington and a fierce critic of Iran. In a June appearance on CBS News' Face the Nation, Graham said the United States would obliterate the Islamic Republic if the country contested control over the Strait of Hormuz, a key waterway that has become a main point of negotiation in the Iran war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a statement that Israel had lost one of its greatest friends. Graham has also remained a vocal advocate for Ukraine, even as others in the GOP distanced themselves in recent years from outwardly supporting the war-torn nation. In a statement, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican South Dakota, called Graham a trusted advisor and colleague, saying numerous presidents and heads of state have relied on his counsel. His influence on the federal judiciary, our national defense, and his beloved South Carolina will be felt for generations, Thune said. Other tributes for Graham poured in early Sunday morning from his colleagues. Senator Mike Lee, Republican Utah, said he would miss his infectious laugh, quick wit, and enthusiasm for life. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican Mississippi, the chairman of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, said there were no words to describe his impact on the foreign and domestic policy of the United States. "He stood solidly for freedom and strength, and he fought for liberty across the globe," Wicker said in a statement. "Lindsey Graham can be succeeded in office, but he cannot be replaced." South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster called Graham the fiercest of fighters for South Carolina in America. In a statement posted to X, "Lindsey Graham is irreplaceable," he said. The sudden death over the weekend of Senator Lindsey Graham sent shockwaves through Capitol Hill, leaving lawmakers reeling in the early morning hours from the unexpected passing of their longtime colleague. It also opened up, at least temporarily, an important vacancy atop a key Senate committee, one that's increasingly an architect of some of the most consequential legislation affecting Americans' lives. The South Carolina Republican was a powerful champion of the Senate Budget Committee. The panel may sound just like another wonky corner of Congress, but it's much more than that. It's also the place where President Donald Trump's biggest second-term legislative wins have originated. That's because budget bills only need a simple majority to survive, unlike other legislation in the Senate that requires 60 votes. Congressional Republicans, on Trump's orders, have become more and more accustomed to muscling big party-line bills through the all-important Budget Committee. They've used that process, known as reconciliation, to slash hundreds of billions of dollars in federal spending and send $70 billion to Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol. Just days ago, the president again directed them to use the Senate and House Budget Committees to attempt to pass a $350 billion Pentagon cash infusion in the coming months, all of that on top of a long-shot effort to pass a voting restrictions bill. Whoever replaces Graham leading the Budget Committee will play a key role in delivering on those GOP priorities, or trying to. Among the other long-serving Republican senators on the panel are Mike Crapo of Idaho and Chuck Grassley of Iowa. However, both are already chairmen of other important committees. With their plates full, Senator Robert Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, is expected to take over. Senator Johnson is prepared to serve as budget chair when announced, Grace Carnathan, spokeswoman for Johnson, said in a statement to USA Today. Rounding out the GOP senators on the committee are John Cornyn of Texas, Mike Lee of Utah, John Kennedy of Louisiana, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, Bernie Moreno of Ohio, and Rick Scott of Florida. Before his July 11 death, Graham helped push two major GOP policy accomplishments across the finish line. The first was the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which has since been rebranded by Republicans as the Working Families Tax Cuts Act, the massive piece of domestic policy legislation passed a year ago, reshaping the country in profound ways from Medicaid and food stamp cuts to a federal student loan overhaul. Democrats often dub it the Big Ugly Bill. The second bill Graham helped steer was the Secure America Act, which infused federal immigration enforcement agencies with an additional $70 billion. It passed both chambers of Congress earlier this summer, even though Democrats boycotted it, saying they wanted significant reforms to ICE. On the night Republicans approved the legislation in the Senate, Graham accused Democrats of obstructing the normal bipartisan process for appropriating federal money. In his view, that defiance forced the GOP to take extreme measures and go it alone. Why are we here? Through the normal appropriations process, Democrats would not give the Border Patrol or ICE one dime, he said on the Senate floor. It just didn't work. A Brazilian national is alleged to have robbed a cash courier of $200,000 at gunpoint last November in Marlboro. Federal authorities arrested Albert Oliveira, 47, on Friday, July 10th, in Florida. He's charged with Hobbs Act armed robbery and conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act armed robbery. The Hobbs Act is a law that specifically targets robberies and attempted robberies that affect interstate commerce. According to a Department of Justice press release, Oliveira and a second man, Kurt Porcher, robbed the cash courier on November 18. According to federal court documents, the two men followed the courier from a Framingham check cashing business to a similar business on Granger Boulevard in Marlboro. Once the courier parked his car outside the business, Oliveira allegedly threatened the courier at gunpoint and stole the money, while Porcher acted as a getaway driver in a rental vehicle, according to court documents. According to court documents, federal investigators used Flock Safety automatic license plate reader data to identify the vehicle used in the robbery and traced it to a car rental business. They then identified Porcher as the person who rented the vehicle, according to court documents. Porcher was indicted in April and is being held without bail. Oliveira made an initial appearance in U.S. District Court in Florida and was ordered held. The case will be transferred to U.S. District Court in Boston at a later date. Each man faces 20 years in prison for each offense, as well as a $250,000 fine. Cases of cyclosporiasis, a parasitic foodborne illness that can cause explosive diarrhea, are being reported across the United States, including in Massachusetts. The illness, which is caused by a cyclospora, chitinensis, a parasite often found on produce, has sickened hundreds of people in at least 18 states since May 1, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and state health data, Michigan topped the count with more than 700 cases. Unlike most bacterial foodborne illnesses that resolve within a few days, cyclosporiasis can lead to gastrointestinal symptoms that linger for weeks or even longer, according to the Food and Drug Administration. In Massachusetts, 18 cases of cyclosporiasis have been reported between May 1 and July 7, according to the state's Department of Public Health, DPH. The number of cases is consistent with what the Bay State typically sees this time of year, the department said. The CDC defines the annual cyclosporiasis season as May 1 through August 31. However, the department said it anticipates additional cases may be reported from this time period, as diagnosis doesn't always occur right after symptoms begin. DPH officials said there's no clear evidence of a cluster or a concentration of cases in any particular location or time period in Massachusetts as of July 8. Cyclosporiasis is generally not transmitted directly from one person to another. In the U.S., people can become sick with cyclosporiasis by eating contaminated, uncooked produce, DPH said. Previous outbreaks have been linked to fresh produce such as raspberries, fresh basil, cilantro, scallions, snow peas, and bagged salad, the department said. As of July 7, the following states have confirmed cases of cyclosporiasis, according to the CDC and local reporting. Alaska, Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin. People typically start noticing cyclosporiasis symptoms about 1 week after eating food or drinking water infected with cyclospora, according to the CDC. Most common symptoms of cyclosporiasis are watery or explosive diarrhea, loss of appetite, weight loss, cramping, bloating, increased gas, nausea, and fatigue. Less common symptoms may include vomiting, body aches, and headache, low-grade fever, and other flu-like symptoms. State health departments have issued guidance for avoiding the spread of cyclosporiasis, which often occurs in the summer due to contaminated, unwashed produce. Avoid consuming food or water that may be contaminated with feces. Avoid drinking or cooking with untreated water. Wash your hands with soap and water after using the bathroom and before, during, and after food prep. Wash all food prep surfaces, including utensils, cutting boards, and countertops, before and after use. Wash and peel vegetables before eating them. Scrub produce with skins like melons and cucumbers well, and cut away damaged or bruised areas on fruits and vegetables before preparing and eating them. Refrigerate prepared fruits and vegetables as soon as possible, within 2 hours. Cook your food when you can, heating food to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 degrees Celsius, or higher kills cyclospora. While the current group of cases have not yet been linked to a singular outbreak or common food item, health officials advised extra caution with foods that have been linked to past outbreaks. The following foods should be washed and scrubbed thoroughly with a brush or sponge. Bagged salad mixes and kits, pre-cut lettuce blends with romaine, iceberg, red cabbage, and carrots. Fresh cilantro, which are coriander leaves. Fresh basil, raspberries, snow peas, and green onions, which are scallions. Ready to soak up this weekend's sunny weather on the Cape? If you're planning a weekend swim, you'll want to avoid the freshwater swimming spots where there may be harmful algae blooms. According to the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, APCC, swimming in water with high levels of cyanobacteria and the toxins it produces poses a threat of illness. Symptoms of cyanobacteria ingestion can range from headache and fever to a nausea and vomiting, or even serious liver damage, warns the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. Heading into this weekend, the APCC lists 4 freshwater Cape swimming spots under watch for bacteria. Here's the full list. The APCC places freshwater swimming spots in 1 of 3 categories: acceptable or low risk for exposure to cyanobacteria toxins, potential for concern or moderate risk, and use restriction warranted or high risk. While only town officials can issue advisories or close beaches, the APCC recommends cyanobacteria advisories for those in the use restriction warranted category. According to the APCC, the following freshwater swimming spots listed by town have concern or potential for concern of bacteria as of Friday, July 10. In Brewster, Cliff Pond is use restriction warranted and has a public health advisory. In Harwich, the West Reservoir is a potential for concern with a public health advisory. In Orleans, the Boland's Pond is a potential for concern. And in Yarmouth, Long Pond is a potential for concern. APCC partners with officials at the town, county, state, and federal levels to conduct cyanobacterium monitoring in Cape Cod ponds, collecting data biweekly. According to the APCC website, the agency typically recommends living advisories after two consecutive tests a week apart show safe bacteria levels. The status of Cape Cod ponds can be checked on the website's cyanobacteria monitoring map. People can also check with the town Board of Health for specific information on local ponds. Hudson's restaurant scene is stepping back into the spotlight this week after a successful restaurant week back in February. The follow-up edition, running through Saturday, July 18, features about a dozen eateries offering prefix menus, discounts, and specialty dishes aimed at attracting diners from throughout central Massachusetts and showcasing the town's award-winning downtown district. The event was organized by the nonprofit Hudson Downtown Business Improvement District, which was also behind the first restaurant week. That inaugural promotion generated enough enthusiasm from both restaurant owners and customers to warrant a second event. "The key part of this whole thing is that we want everybody to benefit," said Richard Braga, district administrator for the Hudson Downtown Business Improvement District. "It introduces more people to Hudson who haven't been here before, and people who occasionally come will come for restaurant week because there are bargains to be had." The week-long event also provides an incentive for diners to step outside their usual routines and explore new businesses, said Kareem El Gamal, a partner in Rail Trail Flatbread Company, Finnegan's Pub, Less Than Greater Than, and New City Micro Creamery. "When all the restaurants kind of get together and we're all offering something to get people inside, it encourages people to come and spend the afternoon or the evening in Hudson," El Gamal said. "People like to do what's called serial dining, have a drink at one place, dinner at another, and dessert at a third, and kind of make a day out of it." Hudson won the 2021 America's Main Street Award, sponsored by Independent We Stand, a national organization that promotes locally owned businesses and endorses the practice of buying from them. Participating restaurants during Hudson Restaurant Week include Cafe 641 at 45 Main Street. Cafe 641 is offering a prefix menu for dine-in only at $20. The deal is good from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. July 12th through 18th and includes a choice of crepe, side, sweet treat, and beverage. T.C. Lando's at 127 Main Street. T.C. Lando's Restaurant Week menu is available during regular business hours from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. For $19.95, dine-in guests can choose from any beer and steak bomb or a large pizza and a 2-liter soda. The Firehouse Catering and More at 5 High Street. Special Restaurant Week offerings at the Firehouse Catering and More are available from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday and Friday, July 16th and 17th, and from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, July 18th. For $23.99, takeout only, diners will get a 16-ounce clam chowder, fish and chips, and Portuguese quejadas. Rail Trail Flatbread Company at 33 Main Street. Rail Trail Flatbread Company is offering Restaurant Week specials all week, excluding brunch. Choices are dinner for two for $40, with a choice of truffle fries or hot tots, Caesar salad or garden salad, small cheese or pepperoni flatbread, or Mexican street corn, or dinner for four for $60. Choose two, truffle fries, hot tots, or mozzarella sticks, plus a Caesar salad or garden salad, and a large cheese or pepperoni flatbread or Mexican street corn. The Main Street Bagel Factory at 51 Main Street. Main Street Bagel Factory's special offer for Restaurant Week is a free bagel with every purchase. This is available from 6:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., Monday through Friday, dine-in only. Harvard Suite Boutique at 25 South Street. Harvard Suite Boutique's Restaurant Week menu, available Tuesday through Saturday during regular business hours, includes a suite sample box for $8, plus three other bakery specials. The Evergreen Room at 12 Main Street. Featured specials at the Evergreen Room are offered from 3 to 6 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday. They include a three-course meal for $44 that serves one to two people. Less Than Greater Than at 28 Main Street. Less Than Greater Than's daily prefix menu is available through Restaurant Week. New City Micro Creamery at 28 Main Street. New City Micro Creamery is offering 10% off all week when you bring a receipt from a business that's participating in Hudson Restaurant Week. Finnegan's Pub at 25 South Street. Finnegan's Pub has specials available all week, such as a free second appetizer, dine-in only. Malahi's Cheese Shop at 162 Main Street. Malahi's Cheese Shop is offering a special of a pre-ordered $15 mini charcuterie boxes for pickup July 15th through 18th. Welly's Restaurant at 23 Main Street. Welly's Restaurant has a prefix special menu available all week for $38.95 per person, including an appetizer, entree, and dessert, except during brunch hours, which is 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Amaya Martini Bar and Restaurant at 176 Main Street. Amaya Martini Bar and Restaurant is offering a prefix menu. It's in effect from 4 to 10 p.m. July 15th through 18th. Kith & Kin at 40 Washington Street. Kith & Kin's Summer Restaurant Week menu is not yet posted. And finally, the Horseshoe Pub at 29 South Street. Under new ownership, the Horseshoe Pub's Restaurant Week details are still forthcoming. Public safety personnel dominated Franklin's top salaries for the 2025 calendar year, with 18 of the top 25 paid town employees being either firefighters or police officers. The highest paid employee was town administrator Jamie Helen, who earned $255,981.03 in 2025. Helen is also this year's president of the Massachusetts Municipal Association's Board of Directors. Superintendent of Schools Lucas Giguere was second at $250,913.36. Police Chief Thomas Lynch was the highest paid member of the police department, earning $226,124.70. Police Sergeant Louis Marguerite III was just behind him at $223,646.05. Of that, $33,311.58 was from details, and $95,040.68 was from additional pay, which comes from various sources, such as overtime or educational stipends. Two fire chiefs made the top 25 list. Now retired Fire Chief James McLaughlin, who left in October, earned $198,185.33, while his replacement, current Fire Chief Charles Allen III, made $188,757.37. He became chief in October, but was a battalion chief with the department prior to that. Three battalion chiefs were in the top 25, Keith Darling at fifth with $214,481.61, Sean Lovely in sixth place with $210,141.12, and Thomas Carlucci in 14th place with $186,435.23. Non-public safety personnel who are among the highest paid include DPW Director Robert Cantaregli, Assistant Superintendents Tina Rogers and Paula Morano, and Assistant Town Administrator Amy Frugaletti. Public safety officials and town leadership dominated the list of Natick's top 25 highest paid employees in 2025, according to records obtained by the Daily News. The newspaper obtained the Town of Natick's payroll records for calendar year 2025 through a public records request. 12 of the top 25 earners earned more than $200,000 last year, with several boosted by overtime and detail pay. Police Sergeant Robert Hoffman topped the list for the third consecutive year, earning $280,977 in 2025. This is a significant increase from 2024, when he earned $243,545. His 2025 take-home pay includes $61,983 in overtime and $65,495 in detail pay. His base salary was $152,198. The town's second highest earner was Police Sergeant Christopher Salis, who brought home $259,073, including $48,899 in overtime and $75,090 in detail pay. Several Natick Public Schools employees also made the list, with Superintendent of Schools Melissa Spash landing third in earning $242,651. She was among three women in the top 25. Other top earning school employees include Assistant Superintendent of Curriculum Susan Balboni, who came in eighth at $212,782. Assistant Superintendent of Finance Matthew Gillis, landing 13th with $198,338. And Chief Technology Officer Dennis Roche, who came in 20th with $185,294. Beach season is nearly upon us. Do you know what the hot reeds are? It's practically a rite of passage to get lost in another world while catching some rays or allowing for some rest and relaxation. And that means a whodunit, a romance, or an adventure. Local booksellers say there's a variety of genres from which to choose for both adult and young adult readers. People are usually looking for something they can relax with for summer reading, said Janet Bibeau, owner of Storybook Cove in Hanover. Most people prefer paperback over hardcover because they're easier to take with you. Here are five works of fiction projected to make a splash this summer, according to area booksellers. Road Trip by Mary Kay Andrews. Bebo said this recent release is a great summer read. It's about two sisters who go to Ireland to figure out if a painting they've inherited is real, and romance follows, Bebo said. Romance has been big lately. There's another category, romanticy, which is a combination of romance and fantasy. It's usually geared for people in their 20s. Mysteries and thrillers are also popular, she said. Yesteryear by Cairo Claire Burke. Kathy Crowley, co-owner of Belmont Books in Belmont, this popular novel has been flying off the shelves. It focuses on the life of a traditional farm wife, a trad wife, who encourages a simple lifestyle, but who actually enjoys a lifestyle with all the modern conveniences, Crowley said. It's a bit of a thriller, a little bit of a time jump, because she ends up waking up in a life that isn't hers and doesn't have all the comfort she was used to. It's different. Whistler by Anne Patchett. Jane Robbins, owner of Booked in Duxbury, strongly recommends Patchett's latest novel. It's about a 53-year-old woman in the Metropolitan Museum of Art whose husband tells her an older man has been following her, Robbins said. The man turns out to be her former stepfather, who is married to her mother for about a year. Robbins said Whistler is a literary book about relationships. It's very good, she said. Anne Patchett has a huge following. I thought it was an excellent read. All of her books leave you thinking about your own family relationships. Best Offer Wins by Marissa Cascino. Casey O'Toole, a bookseller with the Bookshop of Needham, likes the mystery thriller because it's very popular, a quick-read thriller. It's about a woman who lives in the Washington, D.C. area with her husband, and while house hunting, she becomes obsessed with the perfect house, the perfect street, and the perfect neighborhood, O'Toole said. She goes to extreme lengths to find this house and keep it once she finds it. The Summer Girlfriend by Christina Forrest. Ashley O'Regan, lead bookseller at Lovestruck Books and Cafe in Cambridge, said this is the book for fans of Anne Fletcher-directed movies like 27 Dresses and The Proposal. Noelle is too busy to hang out with friends or enjoy her summer vacation, O'Regan said. She's too busy trying to pay for college. Enter Jeremiah, who offers Noelle a job pretending to be his girlfriend for his family's trip to their summer home. Literally spent my entire read kicking my feet at the chemistry from these two, O'Regan said. Raynham's Brody Bamilla is Texas-bound. On Saturday, July 11th, the former Bishop Feehan Ace, 2025-2026 Max Preps Male National Athlete of the Year, and 2025-26 Gatorade Massachusetts Baseball Player of the Year, was selected 89th overall by the Texas Rangers in the 2026 MLB Draft at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. The 6'9 southpaw, who made national headlines and attracted hordes of MLB scouts all spring with a fastball that regularly topped triple digits, went 5-0, giving up 9 runs, 7 earned, on 8 hits and 14 walks while striking out 96, including a Feehan record 20 batters on senior night in his lone complete game, and 44 and a third innings of work while working on a pitch and inning limit, leading the Shamrocks to an appearance in the MIAA Division I final. It could be some time before Bamilla takes the mound for any of the Rangers' affiliates, as on Monday, July 6, he shared an MRI with MLB teams that showed he had suffered another injury to his UCL in his left throwing arm, which he previously had internal brace surgery on in 2025. According to the Boston Globe's Matt Porter, via X, Bamilla is set to undergo Tommy John surgery in Arlington, Texas, in the coming week after signing with the Rangers for an undisclosed amount. Still, the 18-year-old's clear talent and potential was enough to convince the Rangers to take a chance on him, who will work with Bamilla to prepare for his return to the mound and a chance at his lifelong dream of pitching in the majors. Bamilla is the fourth Massachusetts athlete to be selected in the opening three rounds of major North American Sports League's draft this summer. Brockton's A.J. DeBansta was selected first overall in the 2026 NBA draft by the Washington Wizards on June 23rd. While in the 2026 NHL draft on June 27th, Norwell's Casey Mertren was selected 38th overall by the Seattle Kraken, and Needham's Rian Chudzinski was selected 82nd overall by the Anaheim Ducks. The Rangers farm system was ranked 27th overall by Baseball America in its midseason rankings on Tuesday, July 7th. The minor league affiliates of the Rangers, from lowest to highest, are the ACL Rangers, rookie, Hickory Crawdads, A, Hub City Spartanburgers, Advanced A, Frisco Rough Riders, AA, and Round Rock Express, AAA. Vemila had committed to the University of Texas in 2024, but will now forgo college, having signed with the Rangers. There still will be a left-handed pitcher from the greater Taunton area next year in Austin, however, with former Taunton High softball standout and 2023-24 Gatorade Massachusetts Softball Player of the Year, Sam Lincoln, transferring to Texas softball from Texas Tech. It may be the middle of July, but over at Fenway Park, it's the season of the sticks, with a record-breaking four-night takeover from Vermont musician Noah Cahan. For his fourth and final Fenway show of the Great Divide Tour on Saturday, July 11th, Cahan took the stage in his signature French braids and a matching jacket and pants set covered in bugs, which naturally had the B Red Sox logo hidden inside their wings. Bugs, birds, woods, and winding Vermont roads moved through the screen behind a moving house set all throughout Cahan's 2.5-hour-long performance, filled with newer songs like Porch Light and Willing and Able, as well as older favorites like Northern Attitude and Stick Season. After his opener, American Cars, Cahan launched into Doors, All My Love, Deny, 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 and Staying Still, which he introduced as a song for anyone who's had a terrible experience at Logan Airport. Everyone. In a tearful twist, Cahan added Forever into the set list in memory of superfan Zuzu Bane, who died from cancer in September of 2025. Cahan said he played the track for Bane at Fenway during his previous tour, which Bane attended as the final bucket list item she wanted to do before she passed. I learned a lot from her that day. I learned what strength looks like, and what courage and bravery and perseverance can really look like. Whenever things are hard in my life, I try to remember her, Cahan dedicated the performance. With not a dry eye in the ballpark, a phone began to ring, a bit Cahan includes in every show before she calls me back. For the last three nights in Boston, the caller was a New England icon, Drake May, David Big Papi Ortiz, and Rob Gronkowski. The surprise guest at Cahan's final show was yet another New England icon, Cahan's own mother, and she came with some special news. I can't believe you're the only artist to ever sell out four consecutive nights at Fenway Park, but I'm not surprised. I knew you could do it. I've known all along, Cahan's mom said in the pre-recorded message. I also have some big news to share. On behalf of Fenway Park and the Boston Red Sox, you are officially being inducted into the Fenway Music Hall of Fame, she told her son as the crowd erupted in cheers. With the induction, Cahan joins an exclusive group with only three other artists, Billy Joel, Paul McCartney, and the Zac Brown Band. Thanks, Mom. Thank you, Fenway, Cahan exclaimed in disbelief before heading back to the stage for She Calls Me Back, where he was joined by opening act Gigi Perez, adorned in a Red Sox jersey. Any artist on this stage would come up here and tell you they want to spread joy and positivity to all their crowds, right? Cahan asked the audience after Perez left the stage. Wrong. I could not disagree more with that perspective. I think it is our responsibility as massholes, as New Englanders, to wish the absolute worst for everybody around us. I've been to Southie. I know we got some massholes in this crowd, he joked before launching into Dashboard. Soon after, Cahan sprung up on the B stage for a spotlight performance of Orbiter and the first ever performance of 23, Cahan's rare song choice of the night. Before he sang, though, the Vermont musician had some heartfelt words to share about his love for New England. In every way, I do feel like I play for family every time I'm here. So thank you guys so much for always showing up for me, Cahan said to the audience as fireflies lit up the sky surrounding the smaller stage. I want to thank Fenway Park for having me. There is no better place to play music in the entire world. Cahan's band joined him for Paid Time Off, Dan, and The View Between Villages, before heading back to the main stage with backdrops of New England snowfall, Vermont maps, and green state scenery during Northern Attitude and the Great Divide. Just as he did earlier in the show, Cahan then chose to add in a song in memory of someone dear to him who died, this time singing Carlos' song off his debut album. Before singing his final song, New Perspective, Cahan told the audience, I need you guys to access the true New Englander in you and find the part of you that roots for others to fail. Of course, Cahan had come back out for two of his most iconic songs about New England, Homesick and Stick Season. I love you. You all have made my life complete. Thank you, Cahan told the crowd before his hugely popular title track, which ended in an explosion of colorful fireworks over Boston's ballpark. Northern Attitude could be felt all throughout Fenway, even after Cahan left the stage, as thousands of fans exited the venue singing along to Sweet Caroline and chanting Yankees Suck. As for Cahan, he continued to soak up his local fans' love by driving down a packed Lansdowne street with his head out the window leaving behind four nights at Fenway that will go down in Boston history. The City of Framingham is once again offering free outdoor concerts at parks throughout the city this summer with the return of its Friday Night Music Series. The city's Parks and Recreation Department will host performances at multiple locations during July and August, according to a community announcement. Shows are scheduled from 6 to 8 p.m. and will feature a range of styles including rock, pop, blues, Americana, jam rock, new wave, dance hits, oldies, and surf rock, along with a tribute to Stevie Ray Vaughan. Residents can bring blankets or lawn chairs and pack a picnic for the events, which are open to the public, according to the announcement. Alcohol is not allowed at any concert site. The series starts today, July 10th, at Butterwork Park, with Alan and the Alligators and Kevin So, performing rock, pop, and blues. Other shows are as follows. July 17th, The Gravel Project plays Americana Jam on the Center Common. July 24th, Jiggle the Handle performs jam rock at Butterworth Park. July 31st, Radio Musicola performs pop, new wave, and dance at Farm Pond Park. August 7th, Level 6 plays rock and pop hits on the Center Common. August 14th, Larry B. and the Buzz with the Tsunami of Sound will bring 1960s rock and roll, oldies, and surf rock to Bowditch Field. And August 21, Stevie J. and Coldshot, a Stevie Ray Vaughan tribute band, will perform on the Center Common. There are no rain dates. In the event of inclement weather, cancellations will be posted by 3 p.m. on the city's website, according to the announcement. Love watching the sunrise on a beach? One Cape Cod beach is one of the best places to do so, according to a new list from AARP. The association recently released a list of the 8 best sunrise and sunset beaches in the country, and out of only 4 sunrise beaches from all across the country, Eastham's Coast Guard Beach was named one of the best. Here's why and how to go this summer. One of the beaches on the Cape Cod National Seashore, Coast Guard Beach was preserved in 1961 by former President John F. Kennedy, says ARP. Facing east, the beach gives a complete view of the sunrise over an expansive coastline surrounded by golden-lit sand dunes. According to ARP, morning beachgoers can greet the sun as it inches above the Atlantic Ocean into a color-painted sky from the windswept, grass-filled dunes. Coast Guard Beach is open daily at 2 Ocean View Drive in Eastham with restrooms, changing rooms, and rinse showers available. Lifeguard is on duty from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. From mid-June through Labor Day, the beach's parking area is only open to Eastham residents and vehicles with handicap placards, according to the National Park Service. Another parking area is available at Little Creek, with shuttles to and from the beach available. Here are other places named the best sunrise beach, named a best sunrise beach by ARP. South Point Park Beach in Miami, Florida, Kirby Cove Beach in Sausalito, California, and Tybee Island in Georgia. Officials at Southwick Zoo in Minden announced on Thursday, July 9th, that one of its beloved white rhinoceroses, Thelma, died unexpectedly on June 30th. Meanwhile, Louise, Thelma's companion, remains under veterinary observation and is showing encouraging signs, according to a community announcement. Out of caution, she's been taken off exhibit while testing and monitoring continue. To better understand Thelma's death, a pathology team from Tufts Veterinary Hospital conducted a necropsy, according to the announcement. Zoo officials said they're working with additional veterinary professionals from Capron Park Zoo and Roger Williams Park Zoo, along with a specialist from the Wilderness Wildlife Center in Pennsylvania. Staff veterinarians Samantha King and Peter Brewer, along with hoofstock keepers and other zoo staff, have been involved in ongoing care efforts and the investigation, according to the announcement. No age was given for Thelma. Rhinoceroses typically live for anywhere from 35 to 50 years, according to the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Southwick's zoo houses more than 900 animals, representing more than 150 species, according to the announcement. The organization states that its focus is on conservation, education, and animal care, as well as providing guest experiences. The head of the Hopedale Park Commission is facing criminal charges. On Friday, July 10th, the Hopedale Police Department filed criminal charges in Milford District Court against Michael J. Costanza, who is chair of the Town Park Commission. Costanza is charged with 3 counts each of identity fraud, larceny of less than $1,200, and receiving stolen property worth less than $1,200. All charges are misdemeanors. Hopedale Police Chief Ricardo Lima said it was still a fluid investigation and could not comment further. He said he could not say whether the allegations involved town property or money. According to court documents, the alleged crimes occurred on June 12th and June 22nd. Costanza could not be reached for comment on Friday. Assistant Town Administrator Kelly Grant also could not be reached for comment. Costanza is a longtime member of the Park Commission. He was first elected in 2013. He was most recently re-elected in 2024 for a three-year term. A representative of the Milford District Court's clerk's office said the criminal complaint is not publicly available until after a hearing occurs before a clerk magistrate. Costanza is scheduled to appear August 7th for the hearing in Milford District Court. The owner of a Sudbury accounting firm and real estate company was sentenced on Thursday, July 9th, to 2 months in federal prison after he paid an employee more than $1.6 million under the table. According to the Department of Justice, Charles D. Katz also fraudulently obtained more than $179,000 in pandemic relief money. In U.S. District Court in Boston, Judge Leo T. Sorokin sentenced Katz to the 2 months in prison, followed by 2 years of supervised release. Katz had previously pleaded guilty to 2 counts of loan fraud and 1 count of conspiracy to defraud the United States. According to the Department of Justice, Katz employed Stephen Hochberg as Director of Corporate Services for his accounting firm and Chief Operating Officer at his real estate company, but he paid Hochberg under the table so that Hochberg could enjoy tax-free income and Katz's firms, C.D. Katz, LLC, and Jebsco Realty Corp., could pay lower employment taxes. Katz also provided rent-free housing to Hochberg's ex-wife and paid college tuition for Hochberg's children. Katz also obtained a fraudulent $179,900 COVID-19 loan, which he used to pay Hochberg. Hochberg was previously sentenced to 2 years in federal prison and ordered to pay $2,888,288 in restitution. As drone use rises in popularity, Massachusetts legislators have taken some steps to limit them, including passing a bill that would ban weaponizing drones. But in the summer, you may be more interested in rules surrounding their use on the beach. Drone flight is typically subject to federal regulation in Massachusetts, but there are some local rules to be aware of. Whether you can fly a drone over the beach depends on what beach you're at in Massachusetts. Drones are not permitted over the Cape Cod National Seashore, for one, because launching or landing a drone in national parks is generally prohibited, according to the National Park Service. Fireworks, fire lanterns, and launching, landing, and operating drones on seashore lands are all prohibited, the Cape Cod National Seashore NPS website reads. Massachusetts law also prohibits taking off, landing, or operating a drone over any kind or waterways, over any land or waterways managed by the Department of Conservation and Recreation. DCR manages 15 saltwater beaches, including Horseneck Beach in Westport, Scusset Beach in Sagamore, and South Cape Beach in Mashpee, and 32 freshwater inland beaches. Some towns also have specific drone regulations. However, they are generally not allowed to set altitude rules or ban flight over a municipality due to the 2017 court case Singer versus Newton, which said that power rests with the FAA. However, they can set takeoff and landing rules on their own property, and many do. In Barnstable, for example, drones are prohibited from launching and or landing on any town beach. Drones can fly in controlled and uncontrolled airspace, according to the FAA, but there are rules and restrictions. Under federal law, drone operators should avoid flying near a wildlife or hurricane, in and around stadiums that seat 30,000 or more people around the time of sporting events. Drones are barred starting 1 hour before to 1 hour after the scheduled event. They should avoid flying near airports and near facilities such as military bases, natural landmarks, and nuclear power plants that have national security sensitivities. The Early Childhood Alliance of Framingham, a community collaborative administered by Framingham Public Schools that supports early education and child development, has been awarded a $150,000 grant to be paid over 3 years from the Cummings Foundation. The Early Childhood Alliance of Framingham was among 150 recipients chosen from 959 applicants for Cummings grants, which shared $35 million in funding, according to a community announcement. The foundation shifted this cycle to fully unrestricted grants designed to help Greater Boston nonprofits manage rising costs, increased service demand, and uncertainty tied to public funding. The funding is expected to help the Framingham entity restore capacity lost to recent budget cuts in its Parent Child Plus home visiting program, according to the announcement. The initiative provides free support to eligible families by pairing them with an early learning specialist who conducts twice-weekly visits over a two-year period. The Parent Child Plus model delivers educational materials and matches families with specialists who share their language and cultural background. The program focuses on helping children ages 16 months to 3 years build skills tied to school readiness. ECAF leaders said they're grateful for the investment in early family education and efforts that strengthen local families. A coordinated family and community engagement program, the Alliance receives most of its funding from the Massachusetts Department of Early Education and Care, according to the announcement. Framingham Public Schools serves as the lead agency and has supported the effort for more than 25 years. Residents seeking more information or ways to get involved can visit the ECAF website, email gidzel@framingham.k12.ma.us, or call 508-782-6932. The organization also maintains a presence on Facebook at Early Childhood Alliance of Framingham. Additional details about the grant program are available through the Cummings Foundation website. Massachusetts election officials are preparing to send vote-by-mail applications to eligible voters who have not yet requested one, with forms expected to arrive in mailboxes ahead of upcoming statewide elections. The mailing is being coordinated by the Secretary of the Commonwealth's Elections Division, according to a community announcement, and is required under state law to ensure broad access to absentee voting. Each registered voter will receive a pre-addressed, postage-paid application that can be used to request a ballot for both the state primary and the state election, according to the announcement. Completed applications for the state primary must be received by a local election office no later than 5 p.m. on August 25th. In order to be counted. Voters who prefer to cast their ballots in person will have designated early voting windows for both contests, according to the announcement. Early voting for the state primary is scheduled to run from August 22nd to 28th. Early voting for the state election is set for October 17th through 30th. Officials noted that mail-in voting is an option for those who want to complete their ballots at home, while early voting offers an in-person alternative outside the election day itself. Unenrolled voters, sometimes referred to as independents, are required to select a political party when submitting a vote-by-mail application if they plan to participate in the state primary. These voters are allowed to take part in either the Democratic or Republican primary, but they must choose one party's ballot, according to the announcement. Signing up for a party ballot in a primary does not change a voter's affiliation. Additional details about registration, voting options, and election timelines are available online at votenma.com. The Massachusetts Senate on July 9th passed its own version of a social media bill that aims to crack down on youth access while also addressing the concerns of opponents. In April, the State House passed a bill that would have banned social media for children under 14. But critics, and even some advocates, said that the age verification requirement in the bill raised privacy, First Amendment, and legal concerns. In response, the Senate created a piece of legislation that differed significantly from the House bill by disabling certain social media features for minors, but not banning access altogether. The bill before us today will limit the addictive power of social media for kids, promote youth mental health, and help teenagers establish more balanced relationships with technology, Senator Cynthia Stone Cream, Democrat Newton, said on the Senate floor Thursday, July 9th. The bill the Senate crafted ensures that it accomplishes these goals without infringing on users' First Amendment rights, without reducing the ability of teenagers to find community online, and without raising data privacy concerns. The bill passed 38-2. Senator Peter Durand, Republican Spencer, and Senator Kelly Dooner, Republican Taunton, voted against it. The Senate's bill requires that all social media platforms adopt default settings for minors that senators say will limit the most addictive aspects of social media and increase safety. Some of these default settings include disabling the algorithmic feed, disabling autoplay and infant scroll, requiring that users receive a reminder after using the app for 1 hour in a 24-hour period, with reminders following every 30 minutes, turning off notifications from midnight to 6 a.m., and disabling the visibility and sharing of precise geolocation data. You've been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening.